the Capital Investment Committee for February 8th is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance to House Rule 10.01 and is being live streamed by House Public Information Office. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Chair Lee.
Lee, present.
Vice Chair Murphy.
Present.
Representative Erdahl. Representative Erdahl. Representative Igbaje.
Present.
Representative Berg. Representative Berg.
Good morning.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Davids present.
Representative Frankie.
Frankie present.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lucero.
Lucero from beautiful Wright County.
Representative Moran.
Present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Representative Raleigh. Representative Raleigh. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Breyer.
Present.
Representative West.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
All right. And then Representative Erdahl.
Blake, are you able to hear me now?
Yes, I am. Representative Raleigh, you are present. Thank you. And then do we have Representative Erdahl? Does not look like it. All right, Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. A quorum is present. Chair Murphy, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for Thursday, February 3rd?
I move approval of the minutes for Thursday, February 3rd, Mr. Chair.
Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for Thursday, February 3rd. Any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for Thursday, February 3rd are approved. Members, this week we are focusing on the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, FIJA. This is the second of three capital investment hearings that will examine the six core areas of the federal infrastructure package. That is transportation, broadband, water, energy, disaster mitigation, resiliency, and cybersecurity. In December, we held a joint hearing with the Transportation Finance Committee on the transportation provisions. And today we have the Minnesota Management and Budget Office here to provide an overview of the status of FIJA in Minnesota, state matches and spending authority. And then we will move to the broadband and cybersecurity provisions in the bill. The finance chair with purview over those jurisdictions have been invited to join us today. And with that, we'll turn it over to MMB Assistant Commissioner Mange. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Anna Mingy, State Budget Director and Assistant Commissioner with Minnesota Management and Budget. We will be walking through a brief slideshow with you all this morning. Marianne, if you can go to the next slide. Today, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, we'll be walking through the status of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act in Minnesota, the required matching funds for the IIJA programs, agency authority to spend those dollars, and then an opportunity for questions. I would note because you all are hearing from the relevant agencies in so many places, we don't plan to get into specifics about the various programs, but are happy to talk about some of the high level pieces. So first, I want to talk about what we do know about the infrastructure bill. So the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act provides $1.2 trillion in total over 5 years, starting federal fiscal year 2022 through 2026. As you've heard from other presenters, the bill is essentially two different omnibus bills packaged into one. Roughly $650 million of it included the reauthorization of the Federal Surface Transportation Program. And you can see that in that pie chart on the left of the slide. That's really that large blue piece. And the remaining nearly $550 billion funds, general infrastructure investments, focusing on roads and bridges, transit, water, energy, climate resilience and adaptation, and broadband. Since the passage of the bill in November of 2021, MMB and state agencies have been working to dig into the details. As you have heard and will continue to hear, the IIJA contains both allocations determined through formulas as well as competitive grants. The area where we have the best information and insight is in the allocation of those formula grants. And the pie chart on the right-hand side summarizes some of what we know. According to Federal Funds Information for States, or FFIS, Minnesota is estimated to receive about $7.3 billion in allocations. And that's as of the most recent update on February 1st. Most of this funding, or about $6.1 billion, must be matched by non-federal sources. As we'll discuss in a moment, all of the federal awards where we know there's a required state share are accounted for in the governor's supplemental or capital budget recommendations. So let's look at where we expect those dollars to go and what is in that $7.3 billion. The chart here is based on the most recent estimates from FFIS, and it details the formula allocations that Minnesota expects to receive. MMB has also provided a spreadsheet that corresponds to the pie chart, sort of itemizing those allocations by the relevant state agency and the federal agency administering those awards. As you can see, this breakdown really emphasizes the IIJA focus on transportation. So of the 7.3 in formula allocations Minnesota expects to receive, about $5.5 billion of that is going to the Department of Transportation. So clearly MnDOT will play a leading role in the state's implementation of the IIJA. Funding for transit, over $800 million is that green slice of the pie, going to Met Council. Water infrastructure represents about $700 million, mostly going to the Public Facilities Authority. And then some other highlights, there's about $145 million for weatherization at the Department of Commerce, over $100 million for broadband development, and nearly $18 million for state and local cybersecurity enhancement. So one thing that is not part of the IIJA, but was in more recent federal coronavirus response legislation, is there isn't a large flexible pot of funding like we saw in the CARES Act with the Coronavirus Relief Fund or in the American Rescue Plan with the state and local fiscal recovery fund. Instead, it's really authorizing spending on specific grant programs, both formula and competitive, that flow from federal agencies to state governments and other entities. So let's then talk about some of what we don't know. The IIJA includes over $200 billion in federal grants with a competitive component, which sometimes we'll also refer to as discretionary. These competitive grant programs typically require a non-federal match, ranging from 20% to 50% of total project costs. And having a robust match is often key to a successful application. In order to support prospective applications from state agencies for these competitive programs, the governor's supplemental budget includes recommendations to provide matching funds for some competitive grant programs. And we can discuss that more on upcoming slides. But this is a space where we continue to wait for additional guidance about the terms of those programs and timelines. Speaking of guidance, it is a goal of the administration to support timely implementation of this bill in Minnesota, and receiving guidance is a critical component of that implementation, particularly because there are so many new programs in the bill and many existing programs that have been modified or expanded. So agencies are working with their federal counterparts, as you will probably have and will continue to hear, to ensure that we have the best information and resources, and that we are similarly providing comments and feedbacks to federal agencies as they develop program specifications. And then the last thing that we are that we're still waiting on is that appropriations for many of the new programs in the bill and increases to existing programs have not yet been passed. Although the IIJA authorized the funding, Congress has until February 18th, 2022 to authorize appropriations for federal fiscal year 2022 or to pass another continuing resolution. And, you know, although that does introduce some uncertainty, state agencies are still planning and they're still doing the necessary coordination to ensure that they can act quickly once the funding's in place. So next I want to discuss some of those high level areas of programmatic funding in the bill and then how they align with and intersect with the governor's budget. So the tables on these slides identify where governor's supplemental and capital budget recommendations correspond to programmatic changes in the bill that require matching funds. Three of the four lines on this slide are really about transit and transportation. You can see roads and bridges. We anticipate $4.5 billion in total, $599 million, which is an increase over base funding. And funding for new bridge replacement, or new funding for bridge replacement and repairs. And there is match for that, those programs in the change item called multimodal transportation package in the governor's supplemental budget. Similarly, funding for transit, we anticipate a required state match of about $17 million a year. And that is also in the multimodal transportation package. There, the water portion of the bill, required state match is included in a capital budget proposal going to the Public Facilities Authority. And then airport funding is also included in the multimodal transportation package. Since that transportation package is such a big part of the story, I'm going to talk about it a little bit more. So the governor's recommendation for this proposal is a primary source for non-federal match for all the transportation programs in the IIJA. And it includes a transfer from the general fund to the highway user tax distribution fund to be used as a match specifically for programs that fund state and local roads and bridges. But it also includes a general fund appropriation to be used for programs that fund other transportation needs such as transit, aeronautics, pedestrian bicycling, electrical vehicle infrastructure, and more. We can move to the next slide. Broadband, as I mentioned, the state's receiving over $100 million in broadband. That's an area where there is not a state match requirement. The match requirement is actually applied to sub-grantees, and so the state isn't, so there's not sort of a match source in the governor's budget, although there is a proposal for broadband funding. And finally, electric vehicle or infrastructure, or charging infrastructure rather. In addition to the multimodal package at MnDOT, there are two other proposals that could serve as state match, including a capital budget proposal at PCA and a proposal for state fleet at the Department of Administration. Moving to the next slide, there are a number of funding opportunities related to climate in the IIJA, and the governor's budget includes funding in both in that area, one for a proposal for the Department of Transportation, and then also a proposal the Department of Commerce. And the last area we'll highlight is cybersecurity. There is we expect $18 million in grants for statewide cybersecurity with a $4.125 million state match, which is funded through a proposal at MNIT. This table really just summarizes everything we walked through. In total, the governor's combined supplemental and capital budgets contains $372 million in possible state match in the first biennium and $380 million in the tails. You know, these dollars are can also be used by state agencies to help in the implementation of the federal infrastructure bill. So that I want to discuss quickly the agency's authority to spend these federal dollars. As members of the committee are aware, state agencies have to have the necessary authority in order to spend federal funds. There are a number of ways that agencies can obtain that authority. What many members are likely familiar with is the Legislative Advisory Commission process, where the Commissioner of M&B submits requests for review to the legislature, and then commission members have a certain amount of time in which to review the requests. We think that most agencies will seek spending authority for new and additional funds in the IIJA through the LAC process. On February 1st, so a week ago today, we sent instructions to agencies about a session submission that MMB is, we do every legislative session where we collect federal funds for review from state agencies and submit it to the legislature. In this case, because we are aware of the IIJA and all of the new funding, we explicitly, called out that this is an opportunity to receive authority to spend those federal funds. But we also requested that agencies, to the extent they want to use the LAC process for infrastructure bill funding, to connect with the relevant finance committee chairs on their plans for implementing that funding so that the legislature is engaged in our planning efforts. We can go back. Some agencies have will be pursuing direct appropriations to spend these dollars. We understand that that's the approach that MnDOT plans to take for some state road construction funds. And it's just really a matter of past practice. And then some agencies also have existing statutory authority where they are able to receive and spend federal dollars. We think that might appear in the Department of Commerce and the Public Facilities Authority. But again, we're really working with agencies to make sure there's a good dialogue with the legislature so they understand the money that agencies are receiving and the plans for spending. So with that, I am happy to answer any questions.
So Commissioner, real quickly, to the last slide, when you said direct appropriations using the example of MnDOT, is that saying that the federal government will directly appropriate the money to MnDOT to spend? Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry. Thank you for the question, Chair Lee. What I should say is, as the state receives those dollars from the federal government and they're deposited in the state treasury, MnDOT has a practice of working with the legislature for the legislature to appropriate those dollars to MnDOT rather than going through the Legislative Advisory Commission route.
Thank you, Commissioner. And then last question for you. Do we know how much of the $7.3 billion is tied to Congress having a new congressional budget resolution? I saw yesterday that quite possibly Minnesota may not receive $514 million from the transportation funds if there's no congressional budget resolution.
Mr. Chair, I don't know how much is tied to that action specifically, but we can look into it and respond to the committee.
Okay, and then if any of our colleagues from NCSL know, if you could cover that when we go through, that'd be great. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is on, the jobs that'll be created here. This infrastructure is a traditional way of helping the economy, but also not only in the long run, but in the short run. So my question is if you could detail where prevailing wage is involved. So I'm assuming I know the president has signed another executive order on prevailing wage. So do all the projects for example, the Public Facilities Authority, are they paying prevailing wage? Are the the broadband contracts, are they prevailing wage? If you could maybe just, and if you don't have that, you can get back to us, but wondering on the job side of is helping out working families, what the requirements are for prevailing wage.
Commissioner Mangi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have that, but we can work with state agencies to respond to the committee.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members, any additional questions for the commissioner while we have her here? Seeing no other questions, thank you, Commissioner, for joining us this morning. Really appreciate the work that you and MMB have been doing to help us be up to date on the federal bill. Next up, we will now move to the NCESL presentation on the broadband and cybersecurity provisions in the federal infrastructure bill. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Frederick and Mr. York. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you very much. Let me share my screen real quick. Okay, I hope everybody can see that. My name is Trace York, and I'm the Associate Legislative Director in NCSL's Washington, D.C. office, and I staff our Communications, Financial Services, and Interstate Commerce Committee, and I'm joined by my colleague, Susan Frederick, who can introduce herself later, and we really appreciate your time this morning and the opportunity to testify. So I will start off with some broadband. So the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act provided $65 billion in new federal funding for broadband infrastructure and established a bunch of new programs that direct funding toward broadband deployment and affordability. The most significant funding is allocated for a program called Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, which for the rest of this presentation, I'll call the BEAD program. And that it's a program that will be administered by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, which I'll hereafter refer to as the NTIA because the federal government and Congress love their acronyms. So I apologize for all of the acronyms. And the NTIA is an agency within the Department of Commerce. So the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program is a program that through formula-based grants will distribute approximately $42.5 billion in broadband funding directly to the states. The states, in turn, would then competitively award the grants to support broadband infrastructure mapping and deployment through sub-grantees. So the application process is still very fluid at this point, and we'll be looking for some updated guidance from the NTIA in the coming months. But right now, this is what we know. NTIA must issue what's called a notice of funding opportunity for the program within 180 days or 6 months of the bill's enactment, which falls on May 15th of this year. In my conversations with NTIA, they do expect it to take up pretty much the entire 6 months before the notice of funding is available. And so we should anticipate in the May 15th timeframe before that notice of funding opportunity is public. When it is, that the notice will establish basically a process for states to apply for funding by submitting a letter of intent, an initial proposal, and eventually a final proposal, basically explaining the state's plan on using the funds based on a number of templates that will be provided by the NTIA. So what different types of funding will be available in this program? There's basically three pots of money. The first pot of money is a little over $5 billion and is essentially the minimum allotment that that all 50 states and certain U.S. territories will receive, which is $100 million. No questions asked, no application needed. Every state and certain U.S. territories will receive that $100 million. The second category is for specifically for high-cost funding, and it equals about $4.25 billion, which would be allocated for broadband projects based on unserved locations in high-cost areas in each state, which will eventually be determined by NTIA based on a variety of factors that are defined in the law, such as poverty, geographic remoteness, low population density, and a variety of other metrics. The third and largest category is for unserved area funding, which totals a little over $32 billion, and it will be allocated for broadband projects based on any unserved locations in any state. So once a state's application is accepted, NTIA will allocate those funds based on formulas that are defined in the bill, but which basically compare the number of high-cost and unserved areas in any given state against the national average. That's a little simplistic, but that's what the general idea is behind it. Another thing I should mention is that while states will be the entities receiving the funding directly from the federal government, the program does require a substantial amount of coordination by the state with local governments within their state and other regional entities. So, for example, each state will be required to submit basically what's like called a five-year action plan to the NTIA, and that plan must be a collaboration with local governments. So local governments can send in input to the state, and the states will have to report to the NTIA on the types of collaboration that they've had with local governments in their state. There is a matching requirement for the program, which is that a state must provide or must require a subgrantee to provide a matching contribution that is equivalent to basically about 25% of project costs. So in general, the match must come from non-federal funds, although the NTIA will have the ability to waive the matching requirement for high-cost areas if they deem that it's necessary. And additionally, the BEAD program does permit the use of federal matching funds if they were provided to a state under the various COVID relief laws that were recently passed, like the CARES Act, the American Rescue Plan. If there are state or if there is money that the states receive from those plans, the state can use that as matching funds. Again, it may be completely irrelevant if the subgrantee is the one providing the grant, but nevertheless, that is an option. And there's no restriction on the type of entity that can provide the match. The last thing that I'll mention on this, and it's very important, is that at least to get this program launched, the entire program is contingent on one very important thing, and that is that right now the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, has been working very diligently to establish brand new nationwide broadband maps to more accurately determine where coverage is lacking in every state. Most folks that I've spoken to don't anticipate those maps being available until well into this year, and I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't, you know, if they're not available until perhaps early 2023. It's really just kind of up in the air at this point. But the funding for the BEAD program cannot be allocated, not even the $100 million minimum, until those maps are completely done. So that is that helps provide a little bit of a timeline that nothing with this program will go into action until the FCC completes their broadband map. So, we could be looking at the end of this year or early next year before this program starts rolling. So I did want to mention that. So I will briefly touch on a few other of the broadband programs in the infrastructure bill. So one of them also expanded a current FCC program that was previously called the Emergency Broadband Benefit. And they renamed it the Affordable Connectivity Program, which was allocated a little over $14 billion. And that program basically provides a monthly subsidy for low-income families to purchase any internet access of their choosing without having to submit to credit checks. And it requires participating providers to like kind of carry out a public awareness campaign so that folks know that this program is available. It is important to note that the monthly benefit was actually reduced from $50 a month down to $30 a month. However, at the beginning of this year, the FCC did officially launch this program, so enrollment is now open on the FCC's website. The bill also contained $2.75 billion in funding under the Digital Equity Act of 2021 to create different grant programs to be administered by the NTIA that basically promote digital inclusion and help individuals fully benefit, you know, from the digital economy. So low-income households, veterans, rural inhabitants, the elderly, individuals with disabilities, and various populations like that are who these grants are specifically targeted toward. So the first grant is a state digital equity planning grant that was allocated about $60 million for states to develop the planning for digital equity plans. Now, a lot of states have already done a lot of that work, but these grants would be for the planning stage of those digital equity plans to get those started. And applications are expected to be open for those somewhere, hopefully, in the second quarter of this year. The second grant is the State Digital Equity Capacity Grant Program, which was given about $1.44 billion for states that will be distributed through annual grant programs over the course of 5 years to implement the digital equity projects and support the implementation of those plans. And these, you know, the uses for these can include like digital literacy efforts, broadband adoption, tech support, and a variety of other things like that. It's unclear at this point when those grants will be available. And then the third grant is the Digital Equity Competitive Grant Program, which was given $1.25 billion. And it's a discretionary grant program that's distributed over 5 years for the implementation of these projects. The difference is that these grants are competitive and can be given to a variety of different entities that include political subdivisions or agencies or instrumentalities of a state. Tribal governments can apply for these, nonprofits, community anchor institutions such as schools or libraries or hospitals, local educational agencies, and a variety of different entities like that. And the last thing that I'll mention was there was a $1 billion grant program that NTIA will operate for the construction and improvement of middle mile infrastructure on a competitive basis to various eligible entities. So the purpose of this program is to expand and extend that middle mile infrastructure to reduce the cost of connecting unserved and underserved areas to the, I guess, like the internet backbone, basically. And the types of entities that can receive these grants is also very vast. States, counties, cities, tribal governments, public utility districts, nonprofits, electric cooperatives. I mean, the list is very, very long as to the entities that can receive these types of grants. The amount of a middle mile grant to an eligible entity cannot exceed 70% of the total project cost, so there is a matching requirement. And the anticipated opening of this program is most likely going to be probably in the second quarter of this year as well. So that's a very quick overview. I know that's a ton of information, and we'll continue to engage with our federal partners as each program becomes available. And I will now turn it over to Susan Frederick, my colleague, to talk about these cybersecurity provisions.
Ms. Frederick, can you identify yourself and proceed?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Lee and Vice Chair Murphy, members of the Capital Investment Committee, for inviting us here today. My name is Susan Frederick, and I am Senior Federal Affairs Counsel for National Conference of State Legislatures. I work in our Washington, D.C. office, and the reason I'm here today is because I staff our cybersecurity task force at NCSL, and I work on most of the federal cybersecurity issues for the conference. So before I get launched into my presentation, I did want to answer the previous question, Chair Lee, that you had on the appropriation for the funds coming to states. And the answer is yes, whatever states receive under the infrastructure bill is contingent on Congress passing a full year budget for fiscal year 2022. I will tell you that that process is in negotiations, as you've probably seen in the press. NCSL, along with our six sister organizations representing state and local elected officials, we're about to release a letter. Oh, no, we did release a letter urging Congress to do that rather quickly about 4 minutes ago at 10 o'clock this morning. So we are working on that in collaboration with our partners representing the governors and state officials, counties, cities, mayors as well. So hopefully that will spur them along on the Hill. And with that, I'll get into the cybersecurity provisions of the infrastructure bill. This is a $1 billion grant over 4 years. It is not a competitive grant. It is population-based. 25% of what you receive at the state level must go to rural communities. And as alluded to earlier, there is an 80% pass-through to local governments, and I'll come back to that because there's some flexibility involved in how that happens. So the dollars will be appropriated to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, is the subject matter expert on the state plan submissions. So it's a two-agency collaborative process, and there will be the opportunity in your state, if you have multi-entity grants, that the money can go to those multi-entity applicants. So an eligible entity under the terms of this grant is a state, locality, territory, tribe, what you would assume would come under that definition. And I did want to mention before going any further, this is a new grant program. So there's no process in place for this grant. This is brand spanking new. We hope that it will continue beyond its four-year term. So we want to make sure that we get as much information out to the states as possible to make this a successful enterprise for you all and your colleagues in other states across the country and in the territories. So just so you all know, we have joined with the Governor's Association, with the National Association of State Information Officers, and the National Emergency Managers Association to have conversations with CISA, which is the subject matter expert agency on this grant, since the infrastructure bill has passed, and to talk about acceptable terms as far as guidance goes, what would be workable at the state level, what would not be workable. And our primary message to them is we really need as much flexibility written into that guidance language as possible. We want to make sure that there are appropriate guardrails for localities. We want to make sure that there are standards that might be put into place that are attainable by the states. And we want to make sure that there is extensive consultation with all pieces of state infrastructure, state structure and process, to make sure that all stakeholders are included in these conversations. Because as we know at the national level, and as you all probably know, just because one branch of government feels that something is doable doesn't necessarily mean that all of the rest of government feels it's doable. So they are working on guidance language. We have been in extensive conversations with them. When we get questions from the states on implementation, we do send those along to the agency. And, you know, we hope that that guidance language will reflect some of those conversations and the concerns and the tips that we've had on how to make this grant a really robust and viable program. So here's what we do know as a result of some of our preliminary discussions. The money, when it does come down to the states, will probably go to the state Homeland Security advisors. CISA is also considering projects that states undertake that benefit localities, and that could be considered part of that 80% pass-through requirement. So if you have a program in place that localities can tap into, that we have asked that those types of projects be considered as part of that 80%. So it's not a straight-up 80%. You can look at what you're doing currently in your state and decide if, you know, there's a way to you know, include localities in your state program so that that 80% becomes a little bit less than 80%. So eligible uses of the funds are what you might expect: developing, revising, and implementing your cybersecurity plan, addressing cyber threats, and funding any other appropriate activity as determined by the Secretary of Homeland Security. So that incorporates a lot of flexibility. If you can show that what you're implementing at the state level benefits cybersecurity, makes systems more secure, any way you can tie those that plan to creating a robust and secure system in your state will probably be okay. Some of the other requirements: you have to establish a planning committee, which does include representatives from localities. public health, public education, et cetera, and about 50% of that planning committee, you have to have professional experience in cybersecurity or in information technology. So the feds really want your state committee to include people who work in the field, who are boots on the ground, knows what can be implemented and what cannot, and has some, you know, technical expertise as well. However, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. So if Minnesota already has an existing committee, you should build off of that and make sure that you just have the appropriate representation in all the categories that are required. And Trace, you can pop over to the next slide. Okay, so the cyber plan that is required to be submitted to FEMA and to CISA has 16 specific elements that include an assessment of cyber capabilities, a description of state and local roles, resources, and a timeline. So I couldn't fit all 16 requirements on one slide, and I didn't want to, complicate things. So I've summarized them on this slide, and these are the most impactful. This is the most impactful part of the grant process to make sure that you have all of these elements included in your plan submission. One question that I have been asked repeatedly is, what are the security protocols that will be in place when a plan is submitted to the federal agency? How do we ensure that what is submitted by the state doesn't fall into the hands of bad actors who will then use that information to infiltrate state systems? And what I can tell you is that although the feds, to the best of my knowledge, cannot make that information classified because there's something that says they can't classify state information, they are creating a specific portal that will be non-public, and the information will be kept confidential and restricted to only those who are authorized to view it. So hopefully that will, help with, the detail, level of detail that you include in your plan. In terms of timelines and application of the grant process, here's what we know so far. And the agencies are still working on an appropriate timeline and dealing with putting this process into place. As I mentioned, this is a new grant, so there's nothing existing to farm the money out. So here's how they think this should work. So the first thing that will happen is CISA and FEMA will develop an FY22 notice of funding opportunity, and they're working on that now. The states should now be working with localities to develop their plans and projects. So you all should be making sure that that process is starting or ongoing. The next thing that will happen is you submit your plans, the state planning committees and CISOs or CIOs in your state approve those plans, they're submitted. FEMA will review for compliance with the grant protocols, and CISA will review for content. And the next thing that should happen is that FEMA will award the funds. They'll pass through FEMA to you all. And the states will then be able to make sub-awards and report outcomes as implementation occurs. And then going into the next fiscal year, CISA and FEMA, based on what happens in this fiscal year, will develop the FY23 notice of funding. The timeline is a little tricky. It is a little bit up in the air at the moment. They are hoping for the full year appropriations, as I mentioned earlier, to be able to have that money in hand at the federal level so that they can be ready to distribute. Another, I don't know if it's a major stumbling block, but it is an obstacle, is this grant, because it is new and it does solicit information from the states, it is subject to the Paperwork Reduction Act, which basically requires the Office of Management and Budget to approve the plan at the federal level before certain information can be collected from the public. One exception to that rule, however, is that this information that is submitted from the states to the feds could be viewed as intelligence information. And if that is the ruling, then there is an exception to the Paperwork Reduction Act, and the grant process can proceed as intended. So that's where we are at the moment. One of the things that I've been offering up to states when I speak to people is, you know, if you've got questions or if you've got concerns, for, you know, send those along, because I report them directly to the agencies and I can get answers very, very quickly for you. So as you move through this process, if you have a question, please don't be shy. Reach out to NCSL. We are here to get you the answers that you need. And with that, I will turn it back to the chair and happy to answer any of your questions that you might have now. Thank you.
Ms. Federer. And so for members, we are running a little bit short on time for this section of the presentation. And so I'll ask you to be concise with your question. And if we have time remaining after the Office of Broadband, we could come back to these two presentations. Chair Murphy, you're muted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. York and Ms. Frederick, you both talked about two things outside of any broadband control, I guess. The FCC maps must be completed before any money is released. Where is the FCC on those completion of those maps?
Mr. York.
That's a great question. So for a little brief context, I suppose, there was a law that was passed in the beginning of 2020 called the Broadband Data Act that required the FCC to basically revamp their entire program. Over the last 2 years or so, or a year and a half, the program was kind of moving very slowly. At the end of 2020, they received about $100 million. The current chairwoman instituted a data task force, and they started doing a bunch of things. And so I think that they are in a good spot. It's just a matter of being able to obtain the correct data, verify that it's accurate, and then, you know, complete them. So I think this is my best guess. I have talked to the FCC, but, you know, they're kind of coy because I'm not sure that they have a great answer. My best guess is that the maps will hopefully be done by probably the fall of this year. That would be my best guess. It could be September, it could be October, it could be earlier, you know, and so that would be my best guess, would be by the fall of this year. Hopefully the new FCC broadband maps will be done. And then those should be able to, when states are developing, or not even necessarily developing the plan, but when they are done, it will help give states a better picture on where to utilize that broadband funding to be most effective in getting, you know, unserved areas covered.
Chair Murphy, last follow up?
Yes, with Ms. Fredericks then. Mr. York said the fall of 2022. Is that correct?
Ms. Federer?
Yes.
And then what about when will the Paperwork Reduction Act be completed?
Ms. Federer?
That is currently with the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, and they have to make a determination about whether this particular grant would be exempt from those requirements. And I don't know when that determination will be made. I know that both FEMA and CISA are pressing hard to get this grant up and running. They really want to get the money out to the states in the fall. And even, I don't think they could do it any sooner, but, you know, definitely in the fall before the end of the year, so that states can start working on this. So that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty here, but, you know, I know they're all working on it.
Thank you, Ms. Federer. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. York. About the digital equity planning grant and state capacity grants, I understand that the timing is uncertain. How would I encourage organizations who might be interested to get more information in the meantime so that they can start doing some pre-work and thinking about possibilities? Thank you.
Mr. York.
Yeah, I think that basically any kind of publicity to make, you know, to let folks in your state know or companies in your state know that this is something that the state is going to pursue is obviously helpful and solicit their feedback. And I'm also, we are happy to put you in touch directly with the agency folks, to get more details on specifically any kind of help that they can provide. Sometimes, federal agencies can provide various kinds of technical support for states whenever they're doing those types of things. So I think, basically letting folks know that this is available, this is the type of process and the types of programs that we're trying to bolster in our state digital literacy efforts and various technology support. Obviously, broadband adoption is obviously a good thing. I think that's all very helpful in getting people to be, interested in providing the state assistance for those types of programs.
Representative Ryan, last follow-up.
Yeah, thank you so much. My question then still is, where do I get more information on what this is to be able to do that publicity? Thank you.
So York.
Yeah, so I think that I'll connect you, or I can connect any committee member with the agency directly, and I can also send you a variety of different resources that they have available so far that I think we can then have a conversation about how best to promote your efforts in that regard.
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the invite today. Mr. York, by your presentation, it appears but this federal transfer infrastructure bill, the very earliest that we'll see shovels in the ground is sometime in 23 and most likely 24 in Minnesota.
It depends on which program specifically you're talking about. If you're specifically referring to the big B program, which is the vast majority of the broadband funding money that goes directly to the states, I think that I think that states should start seeing the money by early 2023, by early next year. And it could be by the end of this year, but again, it's all contingent on when those new broadband maps are available because the process will continue to be going on. So like I mentioned, the notice where states can start developing their application for the program, that will be available in May, regardless of where the maps are at. So, states can still move forward in that regard. There will be some decisions that obviously will be impossible to make without the new broadband maps, but there still will be progress that can be made throughout the rest of 2022. I'm hopeful that the broadband maps will be available and the NTIA will be able to start releasing that $42.5 billion in funds through the BEAD program by early next year. That is my best guess.
Chair Eklund, last follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just a quick follow-up, Mr. York, is there any federal requirement on prevailing wage, or is that left up to the states?
Mr. York.
Not to my knowledge, as far as the broadband provisions are concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Raleigh. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Ms. Frederick. On the cybersecurity grant program, it's going to be a combination of NIST and best practices and such. Understanding that we're not going to be able to use anything for non-cyber purposes, how would you describe what the purpose of these grants will be? Is the focus going to be on security of the state, of putting together a framework that we're going to use to, advertise that there is a higher level of security, or is this going to be a public and private combination? Can you tell us where you think these funds are going to be spent and how they can be spent? And I'll clarify if I'm not being clear.
Ms. Federer.
Sure. So thank you for the question. I will say that a lot of the chatter that I'm hearing about what to do with the money is, you know, if you've got legacy systems in your state, you know, you can use them to update or, you know, replace legacy systems, legacy IT. That's one area that I hear a lot of talk about. The other one, the other piece of this that I'll mention to you is that only 5% of the money that you receive can be used for administrative purposes. So they really want you to focus on implementation of cybersecurity protocols. It can be education. It can be workforce development, you know, hiring and retaining qualified cybersecurity and IT people to work in state government. That is something we know is a huge challenge because, you know, you get an offer from Google and you get an offer from the state. One is, you know, an $80,000 a year job and one is a $380,000, you know. So there's competition there that, you know, isn't necessarily intentional. So they want you to work on that. They want you to work on cyber hygiene and instituting good cyber practices with your state employees and your local employees. And then they really want to see that there's cohesiveness within the state. So that's why they, you know, they're making you include localities and rural jurisdictions, because the feeling nationally is that you're only as strong as your weakest link. And rural jurisdictions, maybe smaller localities, less urban localities, less sophisticated ones, don't have the same level of expertise or resources available to them to really shore up their information systems and their technology. So that, I hope that at least partially answers your question. I do think there's a lot of flexibility that you can, you know, implement in your plan. So, you know, they're trying to leave it as broad as they can, recognizing that every state is going to have different priorities.
Representative Riley, last follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would you clarify, or would you classify the funds that are going to be able to be used, can they be used only for state agencies, or can these be passed through grants that would go to NGOs or private entities? Do they have to be used by the state, or can they be passed through?
Ms. Federer.
My understanding is that these are state cybersecurity funds. They are not intended to be given to NGOs or private sector entities. So, you know, one of the things that we've been working on at NCSL for at least the last 4 or 5 years is getting a dedicated state cybersecurity funding mechanism in place. So that's what this is.
Thank you, Ms. Federick and Mr. York, for that presentation. Next up, we will be moving now to the Minnesota Office of Broadband Development for an update. Welcome to the committee. Director Dickinson, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm just getting my screens set up here. Good morning, Chair Lee and committee members. My name is Angie Dickinson, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Office of Broadband Development. And my colleague, Devin Bowdry, is assisting me with the slides today. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for dedicating this time to discuss the need for border-to-border broadband access and digital equity in our state. During these extraordinary times, the need for digital equity and high-speed internet access for all Minnesotans has never been more apparent. We are fortunate in our state that thanks to private and public investment, many of our communities have access to reliable high-speed internet service, and we are grateful for the commitment of our state's broadband providers who work tirelessly to keep and get so many of us connected during the pandemic. At the same time, we are also acutely aware of the gaps in broadband coverage in our state and the importance of continuing our work to meet our state's broadband goals. And COVID-19 has certainly intensified our sense of urgency, as so many of us need connectivity, well, for everything, right? This slide gives you an overview of Minnesota's broadband policy framework, also known as the Minnesota Model. When we are asked about our state's broadband plan, we talk about it, how it is highly... equity initiatives in the next year. So I believe it was Representative Ryer asked who to contact about more information about the state's digital equity planning in our work. Please reach out to our office, and I'm happy to share additional information with you also. Next slide, please. So where do we stand on our progress towards Minnesota's speed goals? As you can see, the need for broadband access still exists in our state. This map depicts broadband availability at the city and township level. The yellow areas are townships where less than 50% of the households have access to a 100 by 20 service, which is Minnesota's 2026 state speed goal. Minnesota has made progress toward its 2026 goal, with 89% of Minnesotans having access to broadband speeds of 100 by 20. However, in our rural areas, this measurement drops to 75%. Minnesota has approximately 240,000 households that lack wireline access to 100 by 20 broadband service. Our estimated cost to connect these locations exceeds $1.3 billion. And this estimate is likely low due to infrastructure challenges that folks are facing across the country right now, issues related to supply chain, labor and fiber shortages, rising costs for materials and labor, and the potential permitting delays due to the large number of anticipated infrastructure projects, not just broadband projects, but infrastructure projects on the horizon. Public-private partnerships are needed to ensure applications are submitted for broadband infrastructure to reach all of these locations. After considering current and potential future federal and public investments in broadband infrastructure, along with continued private investment, the governor proposed an additional $170 million in state investment to expedite infrastructure deployment in these unserved and underserved areas of our state. Next slide, please. The final component of Minnesota's broadband model is our border-to-border grant program. This program was created in 2014 and gives us a tool to participate in and collaborate on the solutions to close the broadband gap in our state. This slide reminds us that our grant program is a capital matching program that can pay up to 50% of the cost to build broadband infrastructure in unserved and underserved areas of the state. Next slide, please. Here are some additional highlights of our grant program. The program has received annual general fund appropriations in 6 out of 7 years. During the 2021 legislative session, the legislature appropriated $70 million from the Federal Capital Projects Fund to be used for Minnesota's border-to-border broadband grant program. No state general funds were appropriated to the program at that time. And unfortunately, because of delays at the federal level, we were unable to launch a broadband grant round in 2021. Next slide, please. This slide provides detail about who is eligible to apply for funding through our program. Next slide, please. We're often asked about bonding for broadband infrastructure. Over the years, it has been suggested that the state bond for broadband infrastructure, and MMB and Bond Council have determined that this would not be an eligible use of bonding. Next slide. The next few slides are more for your reference and to give you an overview of current federal programs funding broadband infrastructure. And since Mr. York gave such a fine presentation earlier, I'm going to have Devin move us quickly through these next few slides. Devin, we can go to slide 14, please. Thank you.
I apologize. I don't have numbers showing on my slides.
Yeah, you're good. Thank you, Devin. This slide gives you the timeline of events surrounding the Capital Projects Fund. There's a three-part process for the state to receive these funds. Minnesota submitted its application. The first step was for Minnesota to submit its application. Minnesota submitted that application, and it was accepted in December. We expect to have an executed contract with Treasury in the next few weeks. The next two steps involve submitting an overall grant plan and individual program plans. And the capital projects monies will be used across three different areas. We can go to the next slide, please. The first category is for broadband infrastructure projects that relates to the $70 million that was appropriated by the legislature in last session, and that's the program plan that we have submitted so far. The next two uses are for digital connectivity technology projects and multi-purpose community facility projects. Next slide, please. We hope to have Treasury approval of our border-to-border grant program sometime this month. Upon approval, we are prepared to immediately launch the fiscal year 2022 grant round. We expect to launch two grant rounds in 22 using the $70 million appropriation. The second grant round will be in fiscal year 23. While we are grateful for the federal investment in broadband infrastructure, relying solely on federal funding has hampered the agility of Minnesota's grant program and subjected it to federal timelines along with the federal review and approval, which creates uncertainty. Next slide, please. Here's a more detail about the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and I think you've all gotten a pretty heavy dose of that today. We'll go to the next slide. In the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, Minnesota will receive at least $100 million of that funding, as folks have said. And once the FCC updates their mapping, we'll have a better idea of how we'll end up in that regard. Next slide, please. And that's the end of my presentation. I wanted to leave time for questions, Mr. Chair, so I will turn it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dickinson, good to see you again. Probably the same question. You and I have been through all this broadband stuff throughout the state. Same question's been asked three times or twice today already. Is there any provisions regarding prevailing wage for companies that get broadband grants in the state of Minnesota?
Director Dickinson.
Chair Lee, Chair Eklund, to my understanding, reviewing the Treasury guidance, I'm going to read to you here that the Davis-Bacon Act prevailing wage rate requirement does not apply to projects solely funded by the Capital Projects Fund.
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Dickinson. Appreciate the presentation and the call out on the equity. I will be in touch. My question is about the map on, I think it might be slide 5. Is that available somewhere in a Zoomable format for a more detailed look?
Director.
Chair Lee, Representative Ryer, absolutely, and our team will follow up with you. All of our maps are available on our website and in a variety of formats. We have an interactive map that lets you turn data layers on and off if you are inclined to do that, and then we have some really nice static maps that are easily shared.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last comment. I think that'll be very helpful for not just for us as legislators, but for organizations in the community that might be trying to diagnose issues and understand what they may need to do. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Members, any additional questions for the director? Seeing none, thank you, Director, for coming by today to present in the Capital Investment Committee. Members, having seen no other questions, I do want to remind you all that our next meeting is this Thursday, February 10th. NCSO will be back to present on the water, environment, energy, and disaster mitigation and resiliency provisions in the ILGA. And PFA, Public Facilities Authority Director Jeff Freeman will be on to review the water portion of the federal infrastructure and also to present on the governor's 2020 PFA bonding recommendation. Thank you to all of our presenter, especially our colleagues over at the NCSL for coming by to join us today. With that, members, this meeting is adjourned.